Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Monday, the 27th of February. Israeli and Palestinian officials have agreed to take immediate steps to stop the violence. But even as they met, the killings continued. A boat carrying migrants from Turkey has sunk off the coast of southern Italy. Around 60 people drowned. And
my mum gave her last breath while she was in my arms. You're witnessing the death of everyone you love. It's a horrible thing.
A special report on the trauma felt by the survivors of the earthquake in Turkey. Also in the podcast, the latest on the election results in Nigeria. And after Roald Dahl, now the James Bond author Ian Fleming is facing a rewrite. This has been a bad year for violence between the Israeli military and Palestinian militants, with at least 60 Palestinians and 10 Israelis killed in the past 2 months. Two more Israelis living in a settlement in the occupied West Bank were killed on Sunday in what Israel said was a Palestinian terror attack.
Two innocent Israelis were massacred in their car in the village of Hawara. Unfortunately, the terrorists continue to attack innocent Israelis. We will not be silent. We will do everything in our power to protect our citizens. We will make sure that Israelis will be able to live safely here in the land of Israel.
The Israeli politician Danny Dannon. Later, Israeli settlers were reported to have set fire to Palestinian houses, shops and vehicles in a revenge attack in Hawara. Residents said Israeli soldiers helped the settlers and stopped ambulances reaching the scene. The attack happened near Nablus, where on Wednesday, 11 Palestinians were killed in what was the deadliest Israeli raid in the West Bank for nearly 2 decades. In an effort to restore calm, officials from both sides met in Jordan on Sunday, although the Palestinian Authority was heavily criticised by other Palestinian groups for taking part. Our correspondent Yoland Nell in Jerusalem told me about the talks and what they had achieved.
This meeting was the first of its kind in years between Israeli and Palestinian security chiefs. They met behind closed doors and then put out this statement at the end of the event. What really leapt out at me after almost a decade without direct peace talks is that the two sides said they stuck by past agreements between them and that they would work towards a just and lasting peace. Now, there's another line here about both sides not taking what are termed unilateral measures. Specifically, Israel made a commitment to stop discussing new settlement building for 4 months and said it wouldn't authorise new settlements for the next 6 months. Settlements, of course, widely seen as illegal under international law, but Israel disagrees. And what we believe is that the Palestinians, in return, will not take action against Israel at the UN, although that is not laid out. What's really not clear is what both sides are going to do to try to prevent further violence, because that challenge was made clear really as the talks were going on with these two Jewish settlers who were fatally shot in their car near to Nablus. And now what we have is retaliation for that going on with Jewish settlers attacking Palestinian properties. And we're getting reports of some 20 Palestinians being injured, one seriously in the area there.
And why is the violence so bad at the moment?
I mean, as you mentioned, there's been this very bloody start to the year. And now what's really raised international concerns is looking ahead, because we're approaching the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. This year it will coincide once again with the Jewish Passover holiday, and that will really push up tensions around Jerusalem's most bitterly contested holy site, the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, or Haram al-Sharif as it's known to Muslims, the third holiest site in Islam. It's also the holiest site for Jews, who call it Temple Mount. And even when the holidays haven't coincided, we've seen clashes there between Palestinian worshippers and Israeli police. On top of that, we also had the announcements recently that Israel was planning a lot of settlement construction. The Americans did step in to stop a UN Security Council resolution on that. And we got reports then of a deal in the works. And now that seems to be what has come to fruition today.
Yoland Nell in Jerusalem. So will the outcome of these talks allay fears of a wider conflict and the possibility of another Palestinian uprising or intifada? Martin Indyk has been involved in diplomacy in the Middle East for decades, including a spell as President Obama's envoy to Israeli-Palestinian negotiations and twice as US ambassador to Israel.
Well, my sense is it's already underway, that what we're witnessing is the beginnings of the next uprising, or intifada as you refer to it. None of them are going to be exactly the same as the previous ones. But what we have now, you have a combination of a crumbling of the Palestinian Authority, which is no longer capable of exercising effective security control in major cities of the West Bank. You have young people, they're referred to as this lion's den, who are not affiliated with the traditional Hamas, Palestine Islamic Jihad groups involved in violence and terror, who don't remember, because of their youth, what it was like in the last intifada and the terrible misery that brought to Palestinians, and who have easy access to weapons and to targets, because since the last intifada, there are over 200,000 more settlers in the West Bank. And then, of course, you've got Jerusalem, which is, because of its religious importance to Jews and Muslims alike, and the fact that Israelis and Palestinians live cheek by jowl in that city, that violence can easily flare there. And then you've got Ramadan and Passover coming together again this year in the next few weeks. So it really begins to look like a perfect storm of violence and uprising.
Former US diplomat Martin Indyk. At least 59 migrants have drowned after their boat broke up in rough seas off the southern coast of Italy. A number of children were among the dead. The wooden vessel was said to be overloaded. It is thought it left Izmir in eastern Turkey 3 days ago. Around 80 survivors came ashore near the Italian town of Crotone on the Calabrian coast. Here's our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
The small, apparently overcrowded boat broke up just off the coast in heavy seas before dawn. Footage shows timber smashed into pieces washed up along the beach, along with parts of the hull. A number of survivors, about 80, made it to shore. Images showed them huddled in blankets, being attended to by the Italian Red Cross. Francesca Basile is from the organisation.
What we are doing right now, it's really taking care in terms of protection needs of the people that are finally safe after such a tragic moment.
Some survivors have been taken to hospital. Initial reports indicate the migrants are from Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Middle East and Somalia, although full details haven't been confirmed. A major search and rescue operation has been taking place by air, sea and also using submersibles. But it's still not clear how many people were on board when the boat broke up. It's believed to have crossed from western Turkey on what's known as the Calabrian route, a lesser used route to Italy than the ones from Libya and Tunisia. It's lucrative for people smugglers and the Calabrian mafia, the 'Ndrangheta, is said to be involved. Italy's Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, has expressed her deep sorrow at the tragedy, which she's blamed on people traffickers. Pope Francis, who regularly defends the rights of migrants, spoke to crowds at the Vatican. He said he was praying for the dead, the missing and those who survived. The UN is calling for immediate action to prevent such horrific events. But precious little progress has been made at the European level, despite years of effort.
Danny Eberhardt. More than 50,000 people are now known to have died in the earthquakes that struck Turkey and Syria. As the rubble continues to be cleared, the death toll is expected to rise. Entire villages and neighbourhoods have been destroyed, with the cost of rebuilding put at billions of dollars. The earthquakes have also taken a toll on mental health, and not just for those affected directly. The BBC's Selin Girit has been talking to survivors.
Search and rescue teams were working relentlessly for a glimpse of light as they shouted down to the rubbles. Can anyone hear me? Waiting in complete silence, hoping to hear the faintest voice calling out in return, or even just the sound of a simple movement.
Sorry for my voice. Because of the dust and everything, I lost my voice.
Burak Galip Akkurt is from Akut Association, a voluntary organization focusing on rescue operations. I spoke to him 3 days after the earthquake hit Turkey.
When you hear a voice coming under the rubble,
yeah,
how does that make you feel?
Difficult. It's always like that. It is not very easy to or recover the things that you have seen. As you said, it's so traumatic.
Dilek Hanım, çok geçmiş olsun.
The next day, I met Dilek. She was rescued from another building after 8 hours. But her mom, her dad and her brother lost their lives.
Annem son nefesini benim kollarımın arasına verdi.
My mom gave her last breath while she was in my arms. You're witnessing the death of everyone you love. It's a horrible thing. I don't want the evenings to come. I don't want it to get dark because my own screams scare me.
Tens of thousands of people were killed by the devastating earthquake. Tens of thousands of others were rescued from the wreckage of their homes. But having lost their loved ones, their homes and their towns, they face a life that could be scarred forever. Turkish Psychologists Association started offering free therapy sessions to survivors. Dr. Çağay Dürü says the initial shock may soon be replaced by a phase of denial.
Psychosocial support is quite important for the society in this grief process. We know that 20-25% of people may end up with PTSD and depression, substance abuse, substance use.
This week, another set of earthquakes hit the already devastated town of Hatay. Panic-stricken people were on the streets, crying in despair, wondering whether this is a never-ending nightmare they would need to bear. I am now in Istanbul, away from the disaster zone, but still surrounded by trauma, glued to my TV screen and mobile phone like millions these days. As Istanbul itself lies on a major fault line, people here cannot help but ask, will I be going through the same tragedy in the future? Mass trauma at this scale and how to deal with it is a challenge for this nation as the grief sinks in.
That report from Turkey by Selin Giret. In April, it will be 70 years since the British author Ian Fleming wrote his first James Bond novel, Casino Royale. To celebrate the anniversary, Fleming's books about the spy known as 007 are being reissued, but the publishers have altered some of the wording to reflect more modern times. Richard Hamilton has been looking at the changes.
The 12 thrillers from Casino Royale to Octopussy were written between 1953 and 1966. But now the company that owns the literary rights to these works, Ian Fleming Publications, has commissioned a review by what are called sensitivity readers, which have resulted in certain changes.
There are two ways to disable a crocodile, you know.
A scene from the 1973 movie Live and Let Die, starring Roger Moore as Bond and Julius Harris as Teehee.
I don't suppose you care to share that information with me?
Well, one way is to take a pencil and jam it into the
changes to this
that.
And other Bond and books have resulted in some depictions of black characters, like Teehee, being reworked or even removed. So, for example, in the original Live and Let Die novel published in 1954... Bond's rather withering assessment of would-be African criminals in the gold and diamond trade goes from this...
Pretty law-abiding chaps, I should have thought, except when they've drunk too much.
...to this more sanitised version.
Pretty law-abiding chaps, I should have thought.
And in another passage in the book in which 007 visits a strip club in New York's Harlem district... There's a description of the male crowd becoming increasingly agitated and heated.
Bond could hear the audience panting and grunting like pigs at the trough. He felt his own hands gripping the table. His mouth was dry.
Which has now been turned into this.
Bond could sense the electric tension in the room.
These reissued texts also contain a disclaimer explaining that the spy novels were written at a time when attitudes, which modern readers might find offensive, were more commonplace. And it goes on to say that a number of updates have been made while trying to keep as close as possible to the original text. Last week it emerged that the publisher's Puffin Books were rewriting bestsellers by the children's author Roald Dahl in order to remove language which they considered offensive. But this prompted a backlash from many public figures, including Camilla, the Queen Consort, who gave an impassioned defence of free speech as well as the right of authors to express themselves.
Richard Hamilton. And now here's a quick word from my colleague Andrew Peach.
Yes, you know we love hearing from you on the Global News podcast, and I wonder if you can help us out with something new. We'd like to hear about the sound you really love. Could be a piece of music, could be a sound from the natural environment in your part of the world, the sound of children in your family enjoying themselves, or maybe something really simple like the sound of making a cup of coffee. Drop us an email to tell us about the sound and why it makes you happy. globalnews@bbc.co.uk. And if you can record it on your phone and send it to us as a voice note, even better. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. We can't wait to hear it.
And still to come in the Global News podcast. We meet Ukraine's contenders for this year's Eurovision Song Contest. Millions of people in Nigeria are anxiously awaiting the outcome of one of the closest elections for years. Even as counting was underway on Sunday, voting continued in some areas because of problems on polling day on Saturday. The race has been energised by the emergence of a candidate able to challenge the two main parties that have dominated Nigeria since the end of military rule in 1999. Whoever wins will face a host of problems, kidnapping and other violence, corruption and even a shortage of cash, which has left many of the nation's 200 million people desperate for change. Our Nigeria reporter, Azizat Ola Oluwu, told me the latest from Lagos as the results began to trickle in.
It has the candidate of the ruling party winning a particular, the whole results from all local governments in a particular state in the southwestern region. As of this moment, you know, it's still too close to call because there are still many results being collated that are expected to get to the national headquarters of the INEC Collation Center. And it's quite interesting already on social media because all the supporters of these different presidential candidates are saying that from their own assessment, their candidates are leading. And that is why all journalists and media organizations in the country are very careful of the kind of numbers they put out. They are waiting for INEC to be the, you know, the organization, being the electoral umpire, to be the one to announce the result. And it's quite confusing at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, when are we likely to get a better picture of who is going to win and whether it'll go to a second round?
That may not even happen tomorrow, Monday. It may be on Tuesday that things could get clearer. But at this time, it's still too close to call. And INEC Collation Center has been closed for the day. They say they are going to continue tomorrow. So it means that we are going to see lots of numbers coming in from across the country to be collated at the center in Abuja. Maybe close to the evening of Monday, then we may get clarity. But on Tuesday, yes, we should know if this is going to go into a runoff.
And it's quite complicated because to win in the first round, you need a series of votes from across the country. So is it likely to go to a runoff, do you think?
Now, that's what people are discussing at the moment. Like you said, you can't just win by popular vote. You have to be able to have it spread across the two-thirds of the states in Nigeria. So it's not about you maybe winning the whole states in your region. For example, Bola Tinubu sweeping the southwest or Peter Obi sweeping the southeast where he's from. You have to be able to claim some votes in other parts of the country. And there has to be that spread for them to be able to say that you are truly the acclaimed president. So if none of the candidates is able to pull votes, two-thirds of the majority of the votes across the country, it will definitely go into a runoff.
Our correspondent in Lagos, Azizat Ola Oluwa. Indian police have arrested the deputy chief minister of the capital city, Delhi, for alleged corruption. Manish Sisodia has strongly denied the allegations, describing the charges against him as a political witch hunt. Naresh Kaushik reports.
Allegations of corruption are a sensitive matter for Aam Aadmi Party, which was formed over 10 years ago after a major movement against corruption. Manish Sisodia and the party have dismissed the allegations by the governing BJP and the investigating agencies as dirty politics. But the BJP and the agencies say they have evidence Mr. Sisodia has been involved in corruption as the minister in charge of bringing a new liquor policy for Delhi in 2021. Under the policy, hundreds of new alcohol shops were opened in the city, which were allowed to serve customers until 3 a.m. But Mr. Sisodia later abandoned the policy after police began investigating allegations of irregularities, including the payment of bribes.
Naresh Kaushik. Vladimir Putin's ally Alexander Lukashenko, the leader of Belarus, is on his way to China for a state visit. So what's he likely to be doing there, especially given American concerns about possible Chinese military supplies for Russia? Julian Warriker has been talking to Chris Buckley, a New York Times reporter in Taipei.
The most important event that everybody will be looking to is his talks with China's leader Xi Jinping. And we can imagine there'll be a lot of bilateral issues in the discussions, but I think what the outside world really cares about is what the discussions are about Ukraine and about their respective positions on the war.
We do have the start, at least, don't we, of a plan from China to try and end the Ukraine conflict. Do we know what they're putting forward here?
Well, I hesitate to call it even a plan, Julian. It's more a set of aspirations. It was a set of 12-point principles that China released last week that didn't contain anything particularly new and not anything really specific either, but I think was intended to signal to the world, particularly Europe, that China does want to have a seat at the table in the discussion of the future of the war in Ukraine and possibly how to end the war as well. As I said, it's a very vague document and it's very difficult to see how it could provide a sort of a sound footing for any specific negotiations.
But of course, from the point of view of those who are backing Ukraine in this conflict, if Mr. Lukashenko is on board, they will naturally be wary.
They will be wary. I think it's a delicate balance that both China and Russia are trying to achieve. Both of them, in their different ways, are very close to Russia and Vladimir Putin. In particular, of course, Belarus, which is so dominated by Russian influence. At the same time, in their different ways, they do want to maintain some distance between their positions on the war and Russia's position as well. So I think what we'll be looking for with this visit is just how they manage that. Is this going to be an opportunity for each of them to put a little bit of distance between themselves and Russia? Or is it going to be a more sympathetic position on Russia that emerges from their talks? And then also the questions about any specific cooperation between China and Belarus that may have implications for the war in Ukraine.
And on that, of course, there are those in the West increasingly worrying that China will supply Russia with arms in this conflict.
That has been a consistent message coming out of the Biden administration. Concerns that China has been thinking about providing lethal force to Russia for the war. Now, I think even Biden administration officials are saying they haven't seen any evidence that their weapons or whatever they believe may be supplied has already been supplied.
Interestingly, alongside all of this, the Ukrainian president, Mr. Zelensky, said he would like to meet President Xi at some point. Any possibility of that?
That is a big question, and I'm not sure I have the answer to it. I think one of the questions that would be on the Chinese leadership's mind is that although they don't full-throatedly endorse Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine, their broader relationship with Russia is very important to them. And therefore, I think they're more mindful of maintaining good relations with Vladimir Putin than they are with having a meeting with Zelensky.
Chris Buckley of the New York Times in the Taiwanese capital, Taipei, talking to the BBC's Julian Warriker. The Goliath frog, as you might expect, is pretty big. It can grow up to 32 centimetres in length and weigh more than 3 kilograms. That makes it a target for hunters. But conservationists in West Africa say their efforts to try to save the frog are finally paying off after it returned to the Mount Monaco Reserve in its native Cameroon. Our science correspondent Helen Briggs reports.
The Goliath frog lives up to its name, growing to the size of a large cat. It can jump up to 10 feet. But the world's biggest living frog, which is found only in Cameroon and neighbouring Equatorial Guinea, is threatened with extinction and is classed as endangered. The amphibian has been pursued by hunters for its meat and for the pet trade. Its habitat in the rainforest is being fast destroyed. But 5 years ago, conservationists in Cameroon set out to save the species by encouraging local people to stop hunting the frog and report sightings of it instead. They suggested snail farming as an alternative food source. Their scheme appears to be working, and new nesting sites have been discovered in rivers and streams.
Helen Briggs. Ukraine's victory in the Eurovision Song Contest last year came amid a wave of sympathy following the Russian invasion. Because of the continued fighting, Ukraine is unable to host this year's Eurovision and has handed over duties to the UK. But could the Ukrainians triumph again? Their entry from the electronic duo Tvorchi is a tribute to those who fought the Russians in the Ukrainian city of Mariupol. Our Eurovision reporter Daniel Rosny spoke to Andriy Hutsuliak and Nigerian-born vocalist Jeffrey Kenny.
I know we're not the typical Ukrainian representation of what could come out of Ukraine.
Jeffrey and Andrew, the electronic duo that is Tvorchi.
I cannot explain, tell you how I feel.
Ukraine does Eurovision really well. It's won it three times in the past 20 years. This year, a slightly different direction from 2022's Ukrainian folk rap entry.
Because no matter how bad someone's list.
Ukraine is full of other, you know, types of music and genres and so on, and full of also different people.
You mentioned that you're not the typical Ukrainian act. So what was that like then to get the public vote and the support from Ukraine to say, you two, we want you to be our representative at the world's biggest stage?
We didn't even expect to win, you know. We just kind of went through it because we had a song and we had a strong message. Yeah. And we had a train ticket back home.
Yeah, on the one, yeah.
But then, you know, from the results, they were like, oh, first, when is it tomorrow? And we're like, oh, no, what are we going to do?
Get out of my way, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Tvorchi's Heart of Steel is inspired by the resilience of the Azovstal steelworkers in the east of the country, who last spring were bombarded by Russian forces. Jeffrey, who moved from Nigeria 10 years ago, says he didn't want to leave when the invasion began. Instead, he stayed. But how did a Ukrainian and a Nigerian come together?
Very random. Like, I saw Jeffrey walking in the street. And I was walking, so I came like, hey, like I tapped his shoulder and said, you know what, let's talk. I would like to check out my English skills and I can help you improve your Ukrainian ones if you're interested in. So that's how our friendship started, from just a tap on the shoulder. I did this once in my life and never. That was one decision that I even can explain why, what I was thinking that time, why I came to a random person and said, hey.
A tap on the shoulder now means a gig in front of 160 million viewers in May.
That report from Daniel Rosny. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.